On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Rob Coons about his new book on the five ways of Thomas Aquinas. So we cover all sorts of topics like what are the five ways, how might the five ways have been misunderstood in the past, why are the five ways often dismissed in philosophy courses due to perceived logical errors or outdated scientific assumptions, and how might these criticisms be based on misunderstandings, and what are the fresh interpretations that Dr. Coons is applying to the five ways and to be able to create these into valid arguments once again, and how ultimately is he defending all of these different five ways in a fresh new context? Is divine simplicity essential for properly understanding God's nature? Does it guard against different misconceptions, and much, much more?
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm Matt Natiros. I'm going to be your host today, and I'm here with my co-host Ryan Modisette. We're a podcast dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. We believe that's important and necessary, and we want to foster deeper thinking about these issues and a whole host of others for deeper intellectual engagement in the church in general. So on our podcast, we bring in a whole bunch of guests to talk about these topics and just try to foster that goal. And so to that end, today our guest is Dr. Robert Coons. And Dr. Coons here, he really exemplifies a lot of these intellectual virtues that we value here and want to prize. And so we're going to be talking to him today about a book that is going to be upcoming for him on the five ways of Thomas Aquinas. It's being co-written with Daniel Bonavac. And so this is going to be a little bit of a sneak peek into what you can expect to see from this book and the kind of work they're doing on bringing his interpretation or bringing an interpretation of the five ways sort of into conversation with analytic philosophy. So Dr. Coons is one of the top thinkers here in this area of Aristotle and Aquinas, and just bringing him into conversation with analytic philosophy and retrieving his insights. So it should be a helpful discussion. So on that end, Rob, before we get into the discussion, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what kind of got you interested in these sorts of topics?
Sure. Yeah, Matt, thanks for that very, very generous introduction. So I've been teaching here at the University of Texas in philosophy for 37 years, I guess, 36, 37 years now. So quite a while. I'm beginning to know what I'm doing, maybe, after all that time. Studied my PhD at UCLA, had done some little work before that at Oxford, and started out mostly doing philosophical logic, I guess you could say. And then I've gradually moved into metaphysics and philosophy of religion, especially natural theology, in the last 20 years or so. That's roughly my background. As you suggested in the introduction, my training's in analytic philosophy, although I can read some Latin and Greek, and I have been really interested in Thomas Aquinas' thought for quite a while now, for I guess 30 years now, roughly. So these are our, this is based on a lot of thought and reading and reflection.
Yeah. So in the beginning of your book, you open up with this this quote. You say, as traditionally interpreted, the five ways are terrible arguments, committing elementary logical errors, making unwarranted assumptions, and relying on outdated science. And this is a pretty common impression you get in undergraduate philosophy courses and that sort of thing. So, yeah, could you...
That's the way I was taught the five ways.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
So kind of a two-part question, why bother with these arguments at all? And then for those who aren't really familiar with them, could you give us just a brief overview of sort of what they are and how they function in Aquinas's thought?
In Aquinas's thought, yeah. Yeah, so, obviously the point of the book is that all three of those charges are false, right? that there are no logical mistakes, no serious logical mistakes. No, and there are assumptions, but they're not unwarranted. And it's completely independent of the outdated aspects of science from, either Thomas's day or Aristotle's day, for that matter. So Dan Bonnevec and I have been good friends and colleagues in at UT for a long time, and I'd been working on a new interpretation of the first way, and Dan had developed a new interpretation of the third way. So we said, well, why don't we look at the other three? So we did, and we came up with really fresh interpretations of all five, I think, that where we're driven by a kind of principle of charity, that Thomas Aquinas is one of the most intelligent, well-read, deep philosophers in the Western tradition. And so, and these are very important arguments for him. They occur, you know, in the first part, the second question, third article of this massive book of his, Summa Theologiae. And as Thomas himself says elsewhere, you know, the mistakes at the beginning are really critical. So he's being very careful not to make any mistakes in this early part. So you know, again, we apply a principle of charity. We assume that not everyone's going to be persuaded by these arguments, but we should be able to find good arguments there. And we did once we did a little digging. These are among the most famous arguments in philosophy, I think. Almost everyone's probably who studied philosophy in college has been at least heard about them at some point. They purport, you know, to demonstrate in a kind of scientific way the existence of God, of a being that everyone calls God, as Thomas says it. And and yet, even by Thomists, they've been relatively neglected arguments. No one has given them the really detailed, close reading based on looking at their sources like Aristotle, Avicenna, Maimonides, and applied, and assumed that there are logically rigorous arguments there. So an awful lot of Thomists I read who like Thomas, they'll get kind of hand-wavy for the five ways, you know, well, this sort of suggests there's a God, and then they move on. There's a big conference at Notre Dame, I think it's this month or next month, celebrating his 800th anniversary of his death, I guess. But in any case, I looked at the program, about 100 papers or so, not a single one on the five ways, either individually or collectively. Now, it's not surprising. If you look at the Summa Theologiae as a whole, it's mostly about moral theology, virtues and vices and so on. And issues about the mind and body and the soul and Trinity. There's a lot of interesting subjects to deal with in Thomas. So it's not that I fault them for doing that, but it just reflects the fact that I think that even among Thomists, the five ways don't have the kind of reputation for quality that they deserve, in my opinion.
Right. So you mentioned that you're sort of offering a fresh interpretation of them. I wonder, in your opinion, has he been misunderstood by subsequent thinkers almost from the get-go after him? Or at what point did we sort of lose a proper grasp of him?
I think that's a good question. That's something actually that Dan and I are still working on. But my impression is that the earlier commentaries were much better.
Okay.
And so it's primarily, I think, in the course of the 20th century that a kind of standardized interpretation of Thomas develops, including among Catholics and Thomists, that systematic gets it wrong. especially clear in the third way, actually, where it may have been to some extent influenced by the English translation of Thomas that the English Benedictine fathers produced, which is okay translation, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty of philosophy, it can be quite poor at times. So we found that over and over again, we had to just say, forget the translations. Let's just look at the Latin. Let's look exactly what Thomas is saying. And the third way is a good example. So almost everyone interprets the third way, everybody in the 20th century, as having to do with time in the past, right? If everything's contingent, then at some time, presumably in the past, nothing would have existed, but if nothing existed in the past, nothing would exist now, but things do exist now, so therefore everything's not contingent, right? So that's not, I think, the standard interpretation of Thomas in the earlier commentaries. And the words there that are being translated now, at the present, at some time, always, these words are words in the Latin, especially, that can also mean necessarily, possibly, actually, and so on. And in fact, Dan did a pretty systematic study of this, and he found that in Thomas, these terms are typically used in what we'd call a modal sense rather than a temporal sense. So they look like temporal adverbs, maybe to a naive reading, but they could easily mean something different. And this is, sort of illustrates, again, the principle of charity, because if you interpret it in a temporal way, the argument doesn't make any sense. And again, even the most ardent defenders of Thomas will basically say are embarrassed by the third way and move on to something else. Because, I mean, he starts out by saying something like, again, in the translation, the standard translation, if something's contingent, then at some time it doesn't exist. That just doesn't follow. Actually, even on Aristotle's view, that doesn't follow. And then even worse, if everything doesn't exist at some time, then at some time nothing existed. Right? Again, that doesn't follow. It's people accuse Thomas of some kind of error of logic, so-called quantifier shift fallacy, from everything has a mother to there's a mother of everything, right? Kind of fallacy. The best you can do with it is to say something like, if the past had been infinitely long, and it was possible for nothing to exist at some time, then very likely in the past there would have been nothing. But that's the kind of argument that Thomas never gives, right? Especially not at this stage. These are supposed to be demonstrations of God's existence, not some kind of hand-wavy suggestion that it's somehow likely that God might exist. So anyway, Dan interprets it in modal terms, and then suddenly the argument makes perfectly good sense, right? So if something's contingent, then it's possible that it doesn't exist. Well, yeah, that's what contingent means, right? So that's not surprising. And then the really crucial move is, if everything is contingent, then there's a possible situation in which nothing exists. Okay, that's not obviously crazy, right? In fact, it seems pretty plausible, right? That if there's nothing that exists necessarily, everything's contingent, then you would just imagine a world where none of the contingent things actually happens, in which case it would be an empty world. But then if there were an empty world, right, then from the perspective of that world, nothing would be possible, because possibility for Aristotle and for Thomas both has to be anchored in something actual, in powers and potentialities of actual things. A totally empty world would be a dead-end world, as Dan puts it, a world from which nothing is possible. But that would mean that the actual world would be impossible relative to that world. But the actual world couldn't be impossible. It's obviously possible and necessarily possible. And that involves a very plausible principles of modal logic. So it turns into an interesting argument anyway. Maybe not a knockdown argument there's room for someone to argue that maybe there isn't a dead-end world, or maybe dead-end worlds aren't so bad. But at least it's not a non-starter, right? Not an argument you'd have to be embarrassed by, as the standard interpretation is. And then, as I said, we found similar kinds of problems in the standard interpretations of all five ways. It's as if modern Thomists sort of feel like they're stuck with these standard translations, have to sort of make the best of them, despite their obvious flaws. Whereas we think, no, it's much better to start from scratch, look for a really good argument that is then relatively easy to defend. And we think that we can do that in each of the five cases. Another thing that's sort of surprising to me is that how few people, at least, talking about the five ways, look carefully at the sources. For instance, the third way depends heavily on Maimonides. Well, it turns out Maimonides in the guide has a very similar argument, which is similarly ambiguous. And modern translations interpret it temporally, but it could easily be interpreted modally. But also the fourth way. I mean, in the fourth way, Thomas explicitly refers to Book 2 of the Metaphysics as his source. And I don't find anybody who actually looked at the Book 2 of the Metaphysics, the actual source that he refers to. When you do that, you see that the direction of the argument is exactly the opposite of what most people assume it is. So most people assume that the argument goes something like this, that there is a thing which is greatest in being. And if it's greatest in being, it's therefore also the first cause of everything else that exists. Right? But if you look at Metaphysics, I think it's Alpha the Lesser, the argument goes exactly the opposite way. Right? That is, if there's something that's the cause of all other beings, then it is going to be the greatest of all beings. It will be maximal in being. And the Latin is perfectly, could go either way. There's a kind of identity statement there, or biconditional, which you could go in either direction. Right? You could either go, there's, something is the first cause of all being if and only if it's greatest in being, right? And you can go either direction. In Latin's a little unclear as to which way to go, but if you go back to Aristotle, it's clear. So if you interpret it that way, then the fourth way is already building on the first three ways. So the first three ways establish there is a first cause of everything that exists. The fourth way says, well, then it would have to be maximal being in order to be the first cause. Right? So it'd be appealing to a kind of principle of proportionality of some kind. And so it would be also, I think, a kind of foreshadowing of later questions in the first part, where especially when Thomas talks about the perfection of God, which is, let's see, I forget which question that is, but it's a bit later. Now we take the fifth way in a similar way that, almost everybody interprets the fifth way as a kind of design argument, that we look in nature and we see that things act for purposes. So therefore, there must be a kind of great mind behind the whole universe that is ordering everything for the best, right? Now, Thomas is not averse to design arguments. He does give design arguments elsewhere, including in the Summa Contra Gentiles. But if you look at the fifth way, if it's a design argument, it's the worst design argument ever. it doesn't appeal to any of the facts that you would need to use to make a successful design argument work, as Thomas does elsewhere. So when I look at the fifth way and say, well, what's going on here? If it makes a lot more sense if you think about it as presupposing there's a first cause, and this first cause is an uncaused thing. Right? And what Thomas is saying here is that if you have a purpose, everything for Thomas and for Aristotle, everything has a purpose, right? So teleology is actually a very thin concept in Aristotle and in Thomas. Anything that has causal powers is acting for an end, according to Thomas. It doesn't require consciousness, doesn't require felt desires or anything like that. So he's taking that for granted, right? That all the things that exist have some kind of end. Now, among the things that have an end, there are those things that are intelligent that in some sense give themselves an end by simply looking what's good and act accordingly. And there's everything else, right? Things that are unintelligent. And those things have an end, and they don't give themselves an end, right? Now, maybe they get an end through their very nature. So if it's an earthy thing, in Aristotle's view, the earthy nature naturally goes down, right? So its nature directs it downward. But still, I mean, in order for that to happen, something has to give it that nature, right? With that particular end, there has to be a kind of cause, right? So I think that the fifth way is basically saying, if something's unintelligent, right, then it has to have a cause, right? Now, suppose there's something uncaused, then it would have to be intelligent, right? Because we just said that if it's unintelligent, it has to have a cause. So we've already established in the first three ways there's something uncaused, right? Namely God. So therefore, God must be intelligent. And I think that's all the fifth ways are trying to accomplish, right? It's not an attempt to provide an independent argument for first cause. It's saying, given there's a first cause, what would that first cause have to be like? It would have to give itself its end. Couldn't receive its end from somewhere else, including from its own nature. Therefore, it must be an intelligent being who acts according to for the sake of the good itself, the objective good. So anyway, that's that kind of covers the first, actually 3, 4, and 5 already. So that gives you some flavor of the kind of interpretation we're giving, which applies principle charity, looks carefully at the text, and I'll stop there for a minute. Anyway, see what else you want to ask.
That's really helpful. Uh-huh. One of the things that your work underscores is the importance of reading question 2 and the 5 ways as part of this larger literary unit of which it's a part that runs all the way to question 20. Yep. So what is the importance of reading the 5 ways in tandem with that subsequent material? And how might that shed light on how to best understand the 5 ways?
Yeah. It's a great question. So one thing that's a bit confusing about the 5 ways is that after each of the ways, Thomas says, and this thing we've just established, everyone calls God. And so people read that and assume that he means that each of the 5 ways provides us with an argument that would basically provide all of the characteristics you'd expect God to have: omnipotence, omniscience, goodness, and so on. And clearly they don't do that, as many, many critics, Richard Dawkins and 100 others will say, well, wait a minute. I mean, even if there's this unmoved prime mover, it doesn't follow that he's God, right? So I take again, the most charitable interpretation of that, I think. I mean, one interpretation would be to say it means nothing, so just ignore it. I wouldn't go that far. I think what Thomas is saying is we've established in this way that God has some characteristic, that this being has some characteristic, which only God has. Right. So we have actually narrowed our focus down to this unique being. Right. So in the first way, we'll get to a being that is completely outside of time, outside of any kind of potentiality. Only God is like that. The second cause, something completely uncaused. Only God is like that. Necessary in himself, only God is like that, and so on. So we've established one characteristic of God, right, in each of the five ways, and a characteristic that only God has. And so in that sense, everyone calls this God. That is, we've narrowed the reference down to a single being. But it's important not to try to pull too much out of the five ways. I mean, even the fourth way, let's say, which says that God is sort of maximal in existence, you might say, okay, then we're home free. He's omnipotent. He's all powerful, all good, and so on. I think that if you look carefully at the other things that Thomas says, I think we'd have to interpret that pretty modestly. So what he's really saying is God is a being who's maximal in actuality. That is, he's actually everything he could be, right? He's maxed out in terms of actuality, because that's the principle of proportionality that Thomas actually appeals to over and over again, that actual changes are only produced by actual agents, right? And so the ultimate agent would have to be fully actual in every way, right? And then, of course, later, when he gets to the questions on perfection and infinity, he will then argue that a being that's actual in that full sense of the word will also be immutable, infinite, eternal, and so on. So this is just the first move in a very long argument, right? Very long, complicated argument in the first way, in the first part of the Summa. Similarly, the fifth way doesn't really establish that God's omniscient, right? It just says that he sort of gives himself his ends. So he's aware of the good and acts for the sake of the good. But we don't yet know that he's infinite or knows everything or anything like that. That's going to come later.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So one thing, maybe a kind of set of related questions I'll throw out here, and I'll let you sort of take it where you want. But one common misconception that you point out about these the five ways in general is that they sort of, people take them to depend on this outdated Aristotelian science. And then typically they further go on and treat Aristotle's physics as though it's completely inseparable from his metaphysics. And so I guess what would you say are the essential parts of Aristotle's system that we need for the five ways to be successful? And then, and how much of this is coupled to his physics, and can we sort of shed the physics and keep the metaphysics, as it were.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, to be really precise, the way that Thomas and Aristotle both use metaphysics is somewhat narrower than we use it in contemporary analytic philosophy. So anything to do with form and matter and change and so on is not metaphysics for Aristotle. It's philosophy of nature. So really, there's a three-part distinction here, really, between metaphysics, philosophy of nature, and, let's say, natural science. And there, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, Aristotle himself is aware of these distinctions, and aware that the third category is not the same as the first two, right? And so is Thomas, right? So Thomas will occasionally use examples from outdated natural science as illustrations of his argument, various points, but the argument never depends on that. He's well aware of the fact that those are speculative ideas. So there's nothing, I would argue, there's nothing in the five ways, and it would be crazy if there were, that depends on like Aristotelian cosmology of the crystalline spheres, in heavens and so on. No hint of that whatsoever. Now, someone like Anthony Kenny, in his famous book on the five ways, he goes the opposite tack. He, whenever possible, he attributes the argument to outdated Aristotelian science, and that's just incredible that someone who's proposing to present self-evident demonstrations of God's existence would make them rely on obviously doubtful hypotheses that he himself knows to be doubtful hypotheses about astronomy and so on. So, so there would be a very heavy burden of proof, which Kenny doesn't anywhere near satisfy, to convince me that that's what's going on in Thomas's case. Now, maybe we should talk about the first way briefly, because that's the one where you might think that case is most plausible, right? Where the argument is that argument says, look, there's motion or change in the world. Wherever there's motion or change, there has to be a mover. Things can't move themselves. There can't be an infinite regress. So eventually we get to something that's an unmoved mover. And this is often interpreted in a way that does make it depend on some theses of natural science. So, there used to be a game I played when I was a child. I forget the name of it, where you'd put gears on the board. And then when you finally finished it, all the gears would link up, and then you could turn the one crank on one and all the gears would move and something would happen on the other end. And then you won the game. Right. And I think that's the picture a lot of people have of Aristotle's philosophy of nature or his natural science, that there's kind of a set of gears leading from the heavenly spheres up there. They're turning gears and they're turning gears and they're turning gears. And that makes the stuff happen on the surface of the earth, right? Well, we argue in some detail that nothing like that is actually Aristotle's theory either, even. It's not even his natural science. So we're not even getting the natural science right in the first place. And in any case, an argument like the first way can't possibly depend on such a picture. So the first way, it's a little bit puzzling, right? Because we've got this idea that there's motion, and motion has to have a cause, right? And you might say, well, why couldn't the cause just go back into the past? So the current motion caused by something in the past, that's caused by something further in the past, and so on. And interestingly enough, Thomas himself, in other places, recognizes or believes that such an infinite regress into the past is possible. He calls that a per accidens, or an accidentally infinite regress. So that's actually possible, right? So when he says an egress is impossible, he means a per se infinite regress is impossible, which is the opposite of per accidens. So then the question is, well, what's the distinction, right? How is the distinction supposed to work? And most commentators follow Duns Scotus, in thinking that we can basically identify this distinction with a distinction between non-simultaneous and simultaneous causation. So non-simultaneous causation can go back infinitely far into the past, but simultaneous causation cannot, right? Can't be infinite regress, can't have an infinite regress, right? So then it looks as though Thomas is assuming for some reason that for things, something to change now, there has to be an agent acting now to make it change, right? And so then he can apply this principle, there's no infinite regress, and get to an unmoved mover. But you might think, well, what about inertia, right? Why couldn't we say that the ball is rolling across the lawn and it's moving now because it's been moving in the past? It just carries on by inertia, right? And in fact, Thomas and Aristotle did believe something like that. So they believed that if you drop a ball, it will go down towards the earth by virtue of its own nature, right? To move down. Nothing has to keep pushing it down. It just moves down sort of naturally. And also Aristotle also gives an example of throwing a ball against a wall and it bouncing off. And he talks about a rupe, or force, that's in the ball that makes it keep moving after it hits the wall. So again, it's a kind of inertia. So it seems that there's a puzzle here, right? Which is why do they both think that the explanation for motion now can't be fully explained by motion in the past? That's the question. So here's my thought. We have to really look at Aristotle's theory of time carefully. So we have to go back to the physics where this argument occurs in 7 and 8, and go all the way back into book 4, we introduce the idea of time. And there, Aristotle makes clear that time is, on his view, the measure of motion, right? So motion or change comes first, and then time follows. Right? Now, to go back to our earlier point, this point is a point not of his natural science, but of his philosophy of nature. This is a relatively deep part of his system, and this is a part that you need to make Thomas's argument work. So if you take a much more modern conception of time, which is not a good thing in my view, right? Following Newton and folks like that, where you think of time as a kind of spatial dimension, right? And then change is just having different properties at different locations in that temporal dimension. that's what I would call a static view of time or of change, right? Or Russell calls it the at theory. To change is to be one thing at one time and something else at a different time. If you take that kind of view, then I think the first way can't get started. So the first way presupposes this other picture, which is, I think, metaphysically speaking, a better picture of time and change, actually, because Aristotle can immediately explain why time has a direction to it, whereas the modern view can't explain that at all. Right? You've just got this static dimension. You know, you could go either way. There's no particular reason which time has to go one way rather than the other. So anyway, well, we could say a lot more about that, but I think it's at very least a defensible theory of time and change, right? So therefore, that means that there's an actual question in Aristotle's philosophy, which is, why does time keep going forward? Why doesn't time just stop at some point, right? Or just wind down at some point? And the answer has to be that there has to be a kind of continual source of change that is itself outside of time, ultimately, right? Because nothing in time can explain why time keeps moving forward, right? Because everything's in time, we're sort of trapped at a particular time, and the past can't act on the future, so to speak. It can't extend time into the future. And so there has to be something outside of time that explains the constant movement forward of change, and therefore of time. And that thing has to be outside of time, and therefore has to be a timeless being, a being that's somehow not just unchanging, but by its very nature unchangeable, completely outside of the framework of time. Which also explains another worry about the first way, which is, even if you say that it proves there's a being that's unmoved, how do you know that's God? Well, because the argument really forces you to a being that's immovable by in its very nature, immovable, the immovable, timeless cause of change in time. So then go back to inertia, right? Why does inertia not explain why time moves forward? Because inertia is itself a time-dependent phenomenon, right? Inertia says that if the ball has been moving at a certain velocity, right, and nothing acts on it, and time t arrives, then it will still be moving at that same velocity at time t. But it doesn't explain why time t ever happens, right? Why doesn't the ball just keep moving, and then time never reaches time t, right? It just peters out before we get to time t altogether. Inertia can't help us there, because inertia presupposes there is a time t, right? And so the addition of these new moments of time has to come from something outside of time, ultimately. And that, again, puts us, if that works, if that argument works, I think it's a pretty interesting argument. It gets us a first cause that is obviously supernatural or superphysical in some sense, right? Because all physical phenomena or natural phenomena are going to occur in time. And now we've established the existence of some kind of cause that's outside of time. So anyway, that's a sort of illustration of the kind of thing I have in mind, which is, if we dig a little deeper, right, we can find a basis for the arguments in Aristotle's philosophy of nature, the core of his view. It doesn't depend upon these peripheral, secondary kind of elements of his natural science.
No, that's really interesting. So we spent a lot of time talking about the ways in which Aristotle has influenced Thomas and his arguments. But you also note in the book that Plato, through certain Neoplatonic influences, also exerted a lot of left an impression on Thomas's thinking. So how would you see that influence working itself out in the five ways?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess I'll start out by saying I don't really see Plato and Aristotle as deeply opposed to each other. And indeed, the Neoplatonists in particular didn't think that either. They really saw Plato and Aristotle as being on the same team, and they were just developing Platonic/Aristotelian ideas. Ed Fazer's recently called this the Ur-Platonist school of thought, right? To kind of emphasize the idea that Aristotle is really building on Plato, and I think that's clear. I think Thomas thought of himself really as continuing and perhaps perfecting this tradition that starts with Plato, developed by Aristotle, further developed by Neoplatonism, and so on, as opposed to thinking it in very oppositional kinds of terms. Now, having said that, the one of the five ways that seems to be most Platonic to folks is the fourth way, and that would be. So the idea, again, would be so here's the kind of Platonic interpretation of the fourth way, right? We see different degrees of nobility or goodness or excellence in things, right? So we sort of infer there must be a kind of maximal goodness or nobility, which is the cause of all these lesser things. And that would be a very Platonic kind of argument, right? You see a bunch of red things, there must be red itself, which somehow causes them all to be red. We see a bunch of noble things, there must be nobility itself that causes them all to be noble. I don't think that's his argument, right? Because that's the kind of argument that Thomas and Aristotle both think doesn't work, right? It's just implausible as an account of how these things work. So that's why we looked again, and Thomas says in the fourth way, this is an Aristotelian argument. I'm drawing on metaphysics, you know, book two. So you look at that, and then again, it's pretty clear that Aristotle is saying, given that there's a first cause of being, right, that first cause must be most noble in being, right? So that's not a Platonic view exactly, although you can see how it has Platonic roots, right? Because there still is this idea that God is something like the good itself or being itself, right? And in fact, I would say that Aristotle and then later Thomas solves what's really a problem in Plato's thought, right? Because Plato never really works out the relationship between the form of the good, the ultimate source of all the forms, and God, right? So in the Timaeus, you know, you've got the demiurge, the workman, who's sort of like God, who looks to the forms, including the form of the good, and then looks at matter and kind of organizes the matter according to the forms. So that really puts God in a kind of subordinate position where there's a kind of pre-existing blueprint of the good that he's responding to. And in the Laws, too, Plato's God is really just the source of motion and not really the source of being or existence, right? But I think in Aristotle, we get a much more, I think, elevated conception of God as self-thinking thought, as he puts it, as a being that has the most perfect kind of life. So I think what Aristotle is doing, and then the Neoplatonists pick this up with the one, is they basically identify God with the form of the good. So God is not just a good thing. God is goodness itself, right? And that's clearly something that Thomas, anyway, latches hold of, right? So at this point, right, Plato's right? There did have to be something that's goodness itself in order for other things to be good, but not because of a simple Platonic argument, right? But because of the first cause kind of argument, right? Which establishes there must be a cause of everything else, and that in order for that thing to be the cause of everything else, it has to have certain characteristics, which will then qualify it to be goodness itself, and nobility itself, and truth itself, and so on. And so that plays a very important role in Thomas's theology, ultimately. It's how Thomas is able to solve the Euthyphro dilemma, right? Are things good because God loves them, or does God love them because they're good? God loves them because they're good, but their goodness consists in their participating in Himself, right? So his nature is still the form of the good, right? And that solves that problem. It also makes morality to be not heteronomous, right? So when God tells us to do something through the natural law, let's say, that just is human reason telling us to do something, right? Because He is truth and reason itself, right? So it's not that God is some kind of arbitrary, tyrant here who tells us this stuff to do, and we know we have to do it because He's so powerful. It's rather that the voice of God is the voice of truth itself and the voice of goodness itself, right? And so to be a rational being is to respond to goodness and truth, and so therefore to respond to God, right? So it solves that problem that, you know, that many philosophers worry about, that any kind of Christian ethic is going to be a heteronomous ethic, as Kant would say, that is an ethic where you're allowing yourself to be pushed around by some more powerful being instead of responding to truth and goodness itself. So there's definitely a kind of convergence, you might say, of Platonic and Aristotelian ideas that occurs in Thomas that doesn't involve, I think, just taking sides, but rather developing both traditions to the ultimate point. Right?
I think one thing that strikes me, the five ways differ from a lot of more kind of contemporary work on arguments for the existence of God, is a lot of contemporary arguments seem a lot more shy about the conclusions they're trying to draw from their arguments. Whereas, you know, Aquinas, I mean, he wants the whole shebang, you know, to take these arguments to a full, very rich understanding of the nature of God, God that is established by them. And so one very important piece that also isn't as popular nowadays, of course, is divine simplicity, right? Yeah. And so how do you see that sort of fitting into and being supported by these arguments? And then secondly, how does a commitment to that doctrine then help guard us from other sorts of errors we might have about the nature of God?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is something I think that Thomas is getting from Plotinus and from other Neoplatonists, that that Plotinus saw that where things are composite anyway, where there's a kind of glomming together of elements, there's at least the possibility of a cause of such a thing, right? And what the five ways, especially the first three ways, are supposed to establish is the existence of a being that is absolutely uncausable. That the idea that it might have a cause is completely excluded, right? And you're right. I mean, for Thomas, that idea of simplicity is the crucial thing. So from the five ways, he almost immediately goes to simplicity. In fact, he does immediately go to simplicity. And then from simplicity, he gets infinity and perfection and all the rest of the things, right? So so that's his strategy. And as you say, it's not been a very popular strategy. Already with SCOTUS, it goes in a different direction. So SCOTUS goes to infinity first rather than to simplicity, and doesn't really embrace the kind of simplicity that Thomas embraces. So as you may know, right, Thomas embraces a very radical kind of simplicity, such that God is identical to his own existence, right? His own active existence, to use the technical term, I think. So he's identical to his own nature. So God, his nature, and his existence are all three just one thing for Aquinas, not three different things. And he has some very clever arguments going way back to his early work, Dante et Essentia, that if you have a being that has a nature that's not identical to it, or an existence that's not identical to it, or let's say its nature and existence are two different things, then we'd have to ask, well, what caused them to get together? What added existence to this nature, that looks like that opens up the possibility of cause, right? So for something to be absolutely uncaused, it would have to have an active existence that's not combined with any nature at all, that just is. Now, the worry there would be, well, wait a minute, how can I get from that to anything like God? It looks as though existence is a kind of minimal thing, right? You know, for us, you know, to be a noble being like us, we have to have existence plus life, plus intelligence, plus rationality, and so on. And if God is just existence, he'd be like down there at the bottom level, the kind of greatest common factor of everything. So Thomas is very explicit in several places. That's not his way of thinking about it. That instead we should think of existence as being the maximal thing. So to simply exist is the greatest possible thing. And finite or creaturely existence is existence minus various things, existence contracted to the conditions of finitude in various ways. Now, you might say, okay, that's an interesting theory, but why should I believe it? Well, because of the first three ways, right? Which says there has to be a being that can't be caused. The only way you get a being that can't be caused is to embrace this theory of existence, according to which there could be a being that's just a being of pure existence, and that's the greatest possible thing, right? And then everything works. If you go a different way, then you've got a being that's not uncausable, and you haven't reaped the benefits of the first three ways as you should. So anyway, in the chapter on simplicity, I talk a bit about different theories about existence. So again, when Kenny talks about this, he says, you know, Thomas is just speaking ungrammatical nonsense, right? To say that something just is, you have to be something. You can't just be, right? That's a very classic mid-20th century philosophy of language heavy kind of move to make, right? Look, unless you speak the way I say you should speak, you're speaking nonsense. So you have to kind of liberalize things here a bit and say, well, okay, let's see where the argument leads us, right? I think that we have a kind of conception of existence now. This goes back actually to Avicenna and to maybe all the way back to Al-Farabi, of a kind of element that gets added to things to make them exist in actuality, right? So, for instance, I mean, I've got three kids. I could have had a fourth or a fifth child, let's say. So out there in the realm of potentiality, of possibility, there are various fourth and fifth children of mine, right, who don't actually exist. All of them would have been human beings if they existed. Some of them would have been plumbers and other things, right? So they have all kinds of characteristics, at least in the level of what they could be, or would be perhaps even in various ways. So so we could ask, you know, what is it that makes a difference between my actual kids and my merely possible kids, right? Not really human nature, because in a way, human nature is involved in all of them, right? Not not even the fact that my children have a kind of fully filled out biography, because God could fill out the biography of these possible people to infinite degree if he wanted to. So in the realm of possibility, there's also that kind of detail. So it looks like there's something in addition to that, what Thomas calls an active existence, that gets combined with nature at a certain point and produces an actual child, right? Now, again, you could argue that that's only one among various theories of actuality, true, but it's the only one of the theories of actuality that will agree with the conclusions of the first three ways, right? So it can give us something that's uncausable. Right? So if you can accept the first three ways, you're pretty much forced this theory of existence. So existence is a kind of positive thing that gets added. And then we're sort of forced to conclude that pure existence is unlimited existence, right? Because if existence were itself limited, right? If it were itself like non-living, right? Then living things would be impossible, right? Because if you tried to combine existence with life, it just failed because existence had already excluded life. So existence has got to be the kind of thing that's really compatible with any kind of perfection whatsoever. That's the structure of Thomas's argument there.
Yeah, so I'm thinking for some of our audience who may or may not be super academically inclined and may be thinking, you know, this is all well and good, but I'm not terribly interested in Aristotle or Thomas. But I do think having arguments for God may be important. I don't know. How do you see arguments for the existence of God, whether they're Thomas's five ways or other similar arguments? What function do you think those arguments play for a believer, for someone who is pursuing the life of faith? And where should these kind of conversations be taking place? So, for example, yeah. Do you think pastors should or priests should try to teach these things to parishioners, not necessarily in a sermon, but in other contexts? Is this something that should only be taking place in a college classroom? Where do you see these conversations taking place to sustain the life of believers?
Yeah, great. That's like the hardest question you've asked so far. Because we've absorbed a kind of theory, a theory of knowledge, a theory of epistemology from the modern world, going back to Descartes and others, where human beings are blank slates, right? And by nature, and then we have to kind of build up beliefs by positive evidence and argumentation and so on. And so it's sort of tempting, once we have these kinds of arguments, to think, okay, so all those non-believers out there are just like not like blank slates, right? Waiting to be written on with the five ways, right? And we'll just bring along the five ways, and then they'll become theists. And then we'll bring along some historical evidence stuff, they'll become Christians, and they'll join the church and so on. So it never works that way exactly, right? Because that's not the way human beings work. And Thomas recognizes this too. So Thomas recognizes that, on his view, all human beings have a kind of confused knowledge of God. And I think what he has in mind is something like Lewis's argument from desire, that we're all naturally desire a relationship with God, and natural desires have to have some kind of object. So we sort of implicitly believe there's a God out there. And of course, we suppress that belief in various ways, or it gets distorted in various ways. But if it doesn't get distorted, I do have this confused knowledge of God, and the five ways come along and say, yeah, that's great. That clearly fits with what I would have expected. So Thomas says at one point, when you know there's a God, you're really delighted to find new arguments for his existence, right? I mean, it's like fun, right? To find yet further evidence and further confirmation of the truth of what we believe. So there's that certainly. Now, there are actually a few cases where philosophical arguments did help people along the way, right? Lewis himself became a theist, not because of these arguments, but because of some other arguments involving the argument from reason. I like to talk about Mortimer Adler, who was a famous kind of intellectual mid-20th century, editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, one of the major figures at the University of Chicago and during the Robert Hutchins period and so on. He started out agnostic. He read the cosmological first cause kind of arguments, was convinced there was a God, eventually became a Christian. So it can in certain cases play that role, but it's unusual, I think. Actually, it's the exception rather than the rule. So what's the point of it all? I think one thing I would say is that if a Christian culture is not producing things like this, that's really a bad sign. Right? I mean, it's like if they're not producing beautiful buildings and art and great philosophy, then what's wrong? Right? Something's happening. So we do have this natural knowledge of God. When we develop our philosophical faculties to their nth degree, we will discover arguments, compelling arguments for God's existence. And so we should, right? And it's a way of it's not necessary for salvation, obviously, right? Yeah, you don't have to be a philosopher to be saved, even to be a saint. But it's good in the way that any kind of intellectual excellence is good, right? It does fulfill our end as a human being, as a rational animal, to develop these things if we can. Now, your question about, should the priests or the pastors talk about it in church to the average layperson? It's a good question. I would like to think so, but maybe I'm super optimistic about this. I think it does have some important advantages. So if one might be tempted toward a kind of anthropomorphic picture of God, God is a kind of like Thor from the Marvel comic universe or something like that, right? This would certainly disabuse you of that mistake, right? This would enable you to gain a more elevated conception of God. But at the same time, reinforce the idea, important idea, that God is really incomprehensible, ultimately, right? I mean, the result that we get, and we... five ways point us to this existence of this being, this pure existence, but we don't really know what that means, right? We can't really get our mind around it. It's clearly puts God into a kind of ontological category where most of the normal rules don't apply. And that's, I think, spiritually significant. It also might help us to avoid certain other kinds of theological errors. So some people say, well, how can you believe in simplicity and believe in the Trinity? I think, how can you believe in the Trinity without believing in simplicity? Simplicity is actually crucial to believing the Trinity, because if you thought that God's nature and God were two different things, right, and that God just has this nature, and there's three persons who have the nature, then there's three gods, right, that would just follow, right? So the only way to avoid that is to say that God is, that God doesn't have a nature, God just is this divine nature, which somehow constitutes three persons. That's the mystery, of course, but at least we're not forced by our inadequate theology to say that there are three gods, right, which would otherwise follow. Likewise, I think with the incarnation, I mean, if you didn't believe in divine simplicity, you would have to think that Christ either literally has two different essences, two different things which it is to be Jesus, or that he's somehow some kind of melding together of the divine and human nature into some kind of hybrid nature. Both of those would be heretical, obviously. The first, second would be heretical. The first one just not make any sense, I think. But the Athanasian Creed says that the divine person assumed human nature. Right? So it's not just there's not a single thing that has two distinct natures. There's rather a divine nature, which in the guise of the second person assumes a further nature onto itself without changing ultimately in the process. So it's mystery. I'm not saying it's not a mystery, but the very fact that we have a doctrine of simplicity in play blocks what would otherwise be compelling inferences to either absurd or to heretical conclusions, I think. So it's useful in that respect. Sort of keeps us humble, I guess, right? Ultimately, I think. That'd be my hope.
Yeah, those are great thoughts, Rob. Yeah, maybe just as one final question for you. Yeah, just what are I guess some things, other things you might be working on right now, and then where can people sort of keep up with your work and support your work?
Yeah, thanks. Right, so once we get this done, I've had two big books that I've been thinking about working on. So one is just going to be my view about the existence of God. So just all the arguments that I think are worthwhile, and I think the best form of them, right? So I'm just kind of summarizing everything I've learned over the last 40 years or so. Something like God in the Light of Reason, I think I'll call it. That's my rough title at the moment. And then the other thing, of course, I've been working quite a bit, as you know, on Aristotle's and Thomas's philosophy of nature as they relate to modern science, and but also just how they make sense of things like human beings and the mind and the body and all those kinds of issues. So again, there's going to be a work on hylomorphism, the form matter theory, at some point. The other thing I'm probably going to do some more work on is political philosophy. So I've been thinking about that some recently. I've got a just finished a chapter. It's called a Rawlsian defense of integralism. So, sort of integralism is a kind of view in which Catholic view in which you integrate the political and the spiritual, the church and state in some way. But I'm using Rawls to defend, well, a very liberal version of that, I guess, ultimately, which I think nonetheless is going to be still pretty substantive, actually, where Christian thought would play a central structuring role in the political sphere and wouldn't be relegated to something private. So anyway, that's the sort of thing I'm working on. I've got a website, robkoons.net. I managed to get in there pretty early on because I've got a decent thing. So you can look and find papers there, links to videos and so on.
All right, that's great. Yeah, well, we'll make sure we link to that in the show notes. And yeah, you're definitely going to have to hurry up and get those books out so we can talk to you about them for sure. But yeah, so anyway, yeah, so this has been great, Rob. Thanks so much for doing this interview. Yeah, I think this will be a great book and a helpful contribution to the five ways. We'll make sure once it's out, we can link to it as well. And, yeah, so thank you so much, for the time, Rob, and for everyone, who's listening. And thanks for listening to the only Baptist analytic confessional podcast on the planet.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice.